Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It's Monday, January 9th, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. This is our first week back after taking 2 weeks off for the holiday break. I had a good holiday. I hope you guys did, too. We had some good dinners with friends. I didn't get to go home to see my family, but I had a lot of great support here in the Los Angeles area, and then I was able to take a nice vacation to Hawaii. Unfortunately, I got a little bit sick before we left. I think I caught norovirus, which we'll talk about later in the show, and my immune system was not happy, so when we went to Hawaii, I think I picked up a bit of a bug. You can hear the gravelly nature of my voice during this recording. Headed to the doctor tomorrow. Hopefully, we'll get this taken care of, but in the meantime, I wanted to make sure that we got a new episode up, and this is going to be a good one because it features one of my good friends and someone who I respect immensely, the astronomer Phil Plait. He actually writes the Bad Astronomy blog, which you can find at Slate, and he is the author of two books, Bad Astronomy, Misconceptions and Misuses Revealed, From Astrology to the Moon Landing, quote-unquote, hoax, and Death from the Skies, The Science Behind the End of the World. Phil is also, I don't know, he's just like the go-to astronomer. I think everybody who's listening to the show already knows him. He's very active in social media. He is an expert that's often called upon on television shows regarding space and the cosmos. And he is also a regular contributor, or I should say science advisor, to Hollywood Films. That's really why I reached out to him today, because I wanted to talk about the new movie Arrival, or I guess it's not so new now. And don't worry, we do a good job not to have any spoilers in this episode. Before I dive in, though, I do want to thank a handful of individuals who make Talk Nerdy possible. You guys know that it is and will always be 100% free to download, and that's because of support by listeners like you. There's a couple different ways to support the show. You can visit my website, carasantamaria.com. You can shop in the Talk Nerdy store there. You can pledge your support via PayPal. There's a donate button there for a single-time support or for recurring. I have a couple of people through the PayPal portal I want to thank. Diane Adams and Jacqueline Douglas, thank you so much for your support. And probably the most popular way to support the show is to visit www.patreon.com/talknerdy and pledge to be a patron of the show. This week, I want to thank my top supporters. Wow, this list is getting long. Here we go. Mark Hepburn, Phil Tiber, Timothy Glover, Christian Jeffrey, David Lacer, Jeffrey Perez, Ron Kano Block, Pedro M. Rosario, Mario Barbosa, Stuart Og, The Honorable Husband, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you all so very much. All right, guys, I know you don't want to wait anymore, so without any further ado, here he is, Dr. Phil Plait. Well, Phil, thank you so much for joining me today.
Of course, Kara. How long have we known each other?
I don't Forever, know. Right? Oh my gosh, what a question. Yeah, it's been years.
It's been, okay, an upper limit would be 13.82 billion years.
That's true. I mean, I guess in some senses we may have known each other for that long.
Yeah.
In the molecular sense.
So, you know, when you email me and say, hey, you want to be on my podcast, you know what the answer is going to be. Come on.
Yay. It makes me happy, especially because this is my first podcast back from the break. I always take 2 weeks off over the holidays. And so it's exciting to come back with a bang. I am kind of sick, if you can't hear it in my voice, which is a huge bummer because I just got back this morning. I took a red eye last night. I just got back from Kona from our like annual vacation, and I was sort of sick the whole time I was there.
You were in Kona?
I know. I know how much you love Kona.
Yeah, I've been there three times now.
Yeah, I think I have two, actually.
Once for HawaiiCon and twice for a science vacation thing that my wife and I do. And we can talk about that. I'll be happy to plug my company.
Let's do that, actually, because I want people to know about it. And you do, like, cool adventure travel when you go to Kona. I, like, sit on the beach all day.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well. Yeah. I mean, there's a seahorse farm there.
There is. And I did go to that after seeing your picture with the seahorse curled around your finger. I went, and now I have a matching photo.
Yeah, we're actually we're actually talking about maybe getting seahorses someday. It's a big thing. You need a huge tank. And this is the only place that I can't remember the exact name. If you look up seahorse farm in Hawaii, you'll find it. And they basically breed them there. And it's the only place that does in the country, if not the planet.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about the planet.
I think that they actually were involved in really reducing kind of the, I don't know if you call it poaching, but the fishing of seahorses that were kind of decimating their populations.
And it's an amazing place. You can get a tour of it and you can see the little tiny babies. They're so cute. And then at the end, they got the tanks with the big seahorses that are about the size of your hand, and they can curl their tail around your fingers and you hold them. And if you know, if you want to get a breeding pair, because they mate for life, they're actually really interesting animals. If you want to get a breeding pair, you can fill out an application and they basically check you out. They want to make sure this works, and they ship them in some sort of styrofoam container. I'm not really sure how that works, but some friends of ours went on to this trip with us and actually got a pair, and now they've got, I think, six.
Oh, that is so,
and so
cool.
The reason I was there is that my wife and I run a vacation company we call Science Getaways, where we take groups of people to places you'd want to go anyway, and then add science to them. So we've been to, like, Tucson, Arizona, where we went to an observatory and we had an astronaut and a meteorite hunter, or they're all friends of mine, give talks and do demonstrations. We went up to Oregon, which is just crazy volcanic area. You have no idea how many volcanoes are there. I mean, everybody's heard of Mount St. Helens, but that whole flipping state is volcanic. Dude Ranch is in Colorado. And then the big trip we just did was Hawaii. We did the seahorse farms. We've done hiking into the forest there, go up to the volcanoes. This year we went swimming with manta rays, and we had a manta ray.
Was it a night swim or a day swim?
It's a night swim. And
oh God, that's so scary.
It was, well, you're not really swimming, you're floating. And we had an expert on manta rays come and tell us about them. You know, he's telling us all this stuff about manta rays, and it was really interesting, but for most of us, it didn't really sink in until we went out there, and you're in a wetsuit and you're just sort of floating on a big float, and they have lights shining that attracts the plankton that the manta rays eat. And then these things show up and they are enormous. He told us they're 3 meters across, but somehow that did not get into the part of my brain that says that's a gigantic animal. And they they do these barrel rolls. They swim in big vertical circles. And as you're floating there, they swim 5 centimeters from your face. I mean, literally, if I had pushed my face underwater even a little bit more, that thing would have hit me. It was amazing. So if you're ever in the Kona area of the Big Island of Hawaii, whether or not it's a science getaway or not, holy cow, go do this. It was life-changing.
Do you think that they see you and they just don't care?
Yeah, I think so. I think they're pretty intelligent in a lot of ways, and they migrate. I don't know if it's migrating is the right word, but they certainly travel up and around the coast and come back, and they know where the feeding grounds are. They know, I mean, they're not fish, like, you know, just little tiny brain fish. They've got, their brains are actually quite large, and they know where the lights attract the plankton, and they come and swim around. They have individual markings. Each one is identifiable by these dots. They're white underneath, and they've got these gray dots, and each pattern is unique. Mm-hmm. It was fascinating. I learned so much squishy science while I was there.
I love that. And do you also visit Keck while you're there?
We went up to the it's the Mauna Kea volcano. We went up there once to watch the sunset, but they don't let groups into the telescopes.
Yeah,
and I wheedled and whined, but I couldn't do it. Couldn't get anybody in.
Too many people. Yeah, we actually had a fan of the Skeptics Guide reached out to me this time when I went to Kona, asking if we wanted a tour, because I was only with my boyfriend and another couple. I, of course, got super sick and wasn't really. I know.
Well, I'm glad you're feeling better. I mean, Hawaii, if you're going to be sick on travel, Hawaii is a good place to do it.
You know, that's true. It's funny, you know, the new year comes, everybody's really excited to say goodbye to 2016. The first day of 2017, I don't know what I caught. I don't know what happened to me, but it was the most brutal, insane pain. It was all my guts, only my guts. I was going to the bathroom every 30 minutes.
Probably a norovirus then.
It was horrible.
I've heard that's going around.
Yeah, it was horrible. And so that was on the 1st, and our flight was on the morning of the 3rd. And I mean, there was, we were really considering, like, are we going to have to cancel this trip? But, you know, I was weak the next day, but my stomach was feeling stronger. And so the morning of the trip, I was like, I can definitely go. I'm feeling much, much better. And then as soon as we get to Hawaii, my stomach is fine, but I start getting this like deep rattle in my lung. And that's what I'm dealing with now, is just like a very productive cough. So I'm excited.
That's what you want as a podcaster, is that deep
I know, right?
That resonates. Yes.
It resonates. So it is Sunday. Right now we're recording this on Sunday, January 8th. I am excited for January 9th. Because it means I can call a doctor and go see a doctor and see if I can figure out what is going on and finally get better. I was so pissed too, because I was like, I took my flu shot. But yeah, you're right. It was probably norovirus. I definitely think it was a viral infection, because it hit me like gangbusters, and then it was gone like a day later.
I've had it twice, and both times it hits like a sledgehammer.
Mm-hmm.
And see, in astronomy, there is a term where you have like a black hole surrounded by a disk of material that's falling onto it. This is not a non sequitur. Bear with me.
Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm.
This material falls in and forms a gigantic disk, which gets very hot. And the magnetic fields of the black hole will sort of spin up and get tangled and form these two beams that come out of the top and bottom of the disk. This also happens in star formation, and we see it a lot. And the term for this is when you're blasting material away from the top and bottom in these streams. It's called bipolar outflow.
Okay.
Now you might see where I'm going with this. When you get a good norovirus, holy mackerel, is it bipolar outflow? And it's so easy to forget how good we have it in a lot of ways now in this technocracy we have, if that's even a word, where nowadays, you know, I can get on Amazon or Netflix and download a bunch of episodes of a TV show or a movie or something and watch them on the plane. And the last time I had a norovirus, I was at a meeting in a hotel, and that was before you could do that. This was years ago. And the hotel TV had, you know, three stations. They were showing like Spider-Man 2 over and over again. And I was laid out on the bed. I couldn't read because it made me too sick.
Yeah.
And I just watched that in some terrible dating, you know, reality show.
The TV was tough for me too. I had to kind of make sure the volume was really low because it was making me sick. I didn't have, what did you call it? Bipolar ejection?
Bipolar outflow.
Outflow. I had monopolar outflow, but I will tell you, the monopole made up for the other.
Well, you see that sometimes too. I can't remember what the term for that is, but you can get one of the beams can be stifled for some reason.
There you go. I think it's like, I think I have a psychological stifling because I have not vomited since I was a child.
Wow. Well,
is that weird? I tell people that and they're like blown away, but I think it's forced me to have some sort of weird kind of mental block about it. Like,
I hate it.
It's the worst.
It's anything but puking. And I'm, you're going to have to remove, you know, my leg. All right, fine. As long as it doesn't make my stomach upset.
Right. And so I will sit there cold and, you know, green against like the bathroom floor if it means I'm not going to throw. A lot of people I know are like, just puke, you'll feel better. And
exactly.
I can't do it. But you know what? I don't drink. And I think that has a lot to do with it.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. I think
I've never gotten so drunk I've thrown up.
You haven't?
No.
I'm impressed.
Well, you get to that point and it's like, hey, this sucks. I'm stopping here.
Yeah.
Even close once when I was in college, like the first time I ever drank.
That's a smart way to do it.
And I kind of looked at that and went, yeah, that's just awful. I'm not doing that again.
Yeah, that's not fun. Yeah, I always had the same effect. Like I've never really, I drank a few times and I got really drunk and then I was like, this isn't fun. But I know a lot of people who just push past and they go, yeah, once you puke, you feel better. I never got
that. I'm also not young anymore. And there's a limited appeal to altering my consciousness enough that I actually have physical ramifications for it.
So
there you go. And, you know, I got to wonder if, you know, people coming into this podcast and are like, what the hell are they talking about? Who is this guy?
No, they know. See, Phil, they know you. I bet you, I would say, of course, you know, when you click on the podcast, I will have done an intro. I time travel a little bit when I podcast, but I will have done an intro introducing you. It is spooky. But I bet you 90 to 95%. That's just a statistic I'm pulling out of my ass. Of the people.
The minority is still important, Kara.
The minority is important. We should take care of them. But I think the vast majority of individuals already read your blog on Slate, already see all of your writing and know you from your books and know you from your like myriad television appearances. But that's not all that you have been up to, right? You're not just the bad astronomer lately.
Well, I'm not just in front of the camera, Kara. Actually, I have a lot of stuff coming up too. But last summer, I was honored and very pleased and excited and happy. Any more adjectives I can throw in there? to be the head writer for Bill Nye's new show on Netflix, which is coming, which is going to come out this spring, called Bill Nye Saves the World. And I can't talk about it in detail, except to say, if you look it up online, you'll find the press release that Netflix put out, and there's some information there. But it was really a lot of fun to work on, and I'm really excited to see this thing come out on Netflix. It's 13 episodes, and you'll be able to binge them all.
I can't wait to see it too. You know, I had a lot of friends working on the show, not just you, but a couple other science writers and some correspondents that I'm friends with. I'm probably not allowed to say this, but I'm going to anyway. I even got to be a guest in one of the panels. So it was really cool being able to go to set and do that. So I'm super excited to see the show come out because I know nothing about it.
I can neither confirm nor deny anything you're saying.
Exactly. So I get to be an audience that has like a little nod to it, a little wink to it. So it'll be really fun to see that come to fruition. And finally, another cool, young, hip science show for my generation. I love it anytime we see good science getting on the airwaves. It is such an uphill battle, as both you and I can attest to, doing what we do for a living. And so every victory like that is a big victory, I think, for the whole community. So I'm really pumped to see it. I know we don't know when it's going to come out yet, but it'll definitely be 2017.
Yeah, sometime this spring is what they announced in the press release. And, we live in an interesting time, and in a sense, it's like the traditional Chinese curse, which I don't even know if that's even really a Chinese curse. Everybody just talks about it. It's probably just an urban legend, but, you know, may you live in interesting times. But we kind of do. There's, you know, for all of the gloom and doom, and let me say, the deservedly scary existential crisis we're entering right now, with the new presidential administration, make a list of the problems with it. Science is a big one. The climate change denying, evolution denying people who are going to be taking over our country, all of that is very scary. On the other hand, science is taking a really solid role in public awareness. When you talk to people about climate change, the majority of people are concerned about it and want action taken. When it comes to just public consciousness of science, you look on TV and you look in the movies, and it's got its role. It's actually a growing role. We're seeing not just better science in the movies and on TV, but science procedurals, looking at evidence, going to conclusions, finding, you know, every procedural on TV, whether it's a lawyer show, a cop show, doctor show, whatever, you can't just have a doctor look at the patient and say, oh yeah, they have, diverticulitis. That's not a very interesting plot. They have to find, you know, something goes wrong. They have to find this other evidence. They have to go a little bit on intuition and previous cases, previous knowledge. That's all science. And now it's getting its place. I think it's due. We're seeing more of that done correctly. And it's a lot of it is because there are directors and writers and showrunners who care. They were grown. They were they came of age, I guess, where science fiction was all around them now. People my age, you know, grew up on Lost in Space and Star Trek and Space 1999, whatever. And now they're making shows and they want that science to be right. And so you've got groups like the Science and Entertainment Exchange out in California and DC that are trying to get entertainment industry people and scientists together to portray science and scientists better. And I'm seeing that everywhere now.
It's true. How much do you work with the Science and Entertainment Exchange?
It's sort of unofficial. They call me on occasion if there's somebody who wants better science for a movie or a TV show, or even I did a video game last year where there's a little bit of astronomy in it or space exploration. Now they have on their list a bunch of people from NASA and JPL, a lot of scientists who are way better at this stuff than I am. But, you know, we all have our expertise. And I'm actually working on a project now that I cannot announce, but it is a science fiction sort of a thing. And my expertise in this particular topic, they called me and I'm having a great time with it. And the people involved are super interested in getting the science right. And
isn't that nice? Because that's not always the case.
It's not always the case. And what I try to do now is when they ask me a question, I say, why do you want to know? You know, what is it you're trying to drive at with the plot? Because then what'll happen is I'll say, if you want this to happen, here's another way. And not only will that work, but it'll give you these other subplots you could use. And they're like, I didn't know that. It's like, yeah, the real science can drive the story in directions even the writers weren't aware of. And I love it when that happens.
Yeah, you don't always have to take kind of the low-hanging fruit when it comes to writing a plot and being true to the science, which we see a lot of times, kind of a lazy approach. And I don't know if I want to blame like the writers or the director so much as the fact that if you're not going through the Science and Entertainment Exchange, or you're not lucky enough to know a lot of scientists, a lot of scientific experts, or maybe you just don't know where to look, it's daunting to try to make sure that something that you say is reasonable. But it's such a, you know, it's such a frustrating thing for anybody who is remotely scientifically literate when they watch a film and they're like, why didn't they just do it this way?
Right.
Then it would have solved all those problems. And now it's really hard for me to suspend disbelief anymore. And so it's cool to see that there's a movement in that direction that almost every blockbuster science movie, or I should say movie that has any sort of scientific subplot to it, a science character, a sci-fi sort of vibe to it, almost every movie now employs science advisors. And like you said, like big names lots of times from NASA or JPL or from different institutes, government institutes, or just everyday scientists who kind of get what it means to help out on a Hollywood film. Because of course you can't have an ego, right? They may not listen to anything you say.
Well, that's the case, right? I mean, Armageddon had a science advisor. So, you know, what are you going to do?
Yep. I actually know the science advisor, and so I think you do too, for Prometheus. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah, sure.
And it's a bummer because he's also been an advisor on incredible films.
Yeah, and Prometheus, well, that has a long and storied history of the original, the original script, which I've seen and was quite good, and then it got changed and it wasn't as good.
Yeah, but there are still some things in it that are scientifically accurate, and so that's the interesting part too. It's kind of like, what do they want to know? What do they want to change? What are they going to actually take to heart? And what are they going to ignore? And also, I think anybody who kind of works with one foot in both worlds, entertainment and science, knows that the science has to be in service to the plot. The plot can't be in service to the science.
That's absolutely correct.
It doesn't work that way.
Now, Kevin Grazier is a friend of mine. He's an astronomer, and he's been a science advisor for a lot of shows we all like. Eureka, Battlestar Galactica, Defiance, the movie Gravity, for example. He's done a lot of stuff, and he and I have talked about this at length. And I actually wrote, he's got a book called Hollyweird Science. It's a lot of fun. I recommend it. And I wrote a chapter for another one of his books about science in the movies and how I used to come down really hard on it. It's so easy to be a critic and say, oh my gosh, the science in this movie is so terrible and I hate it and da da da. And it's easy to kind of vent that way, but it's hard to come into the creative process and prevent that movie from being hard, from being bad on the science. And I told the story of how I had my head handed to me by a guy who basically said, oh yes, I worked on that movie and I did this and this. And I said, oh yeah, that looked great. And he said, yeah, we totally faked that. That piece of equipment was just a cardboard box or something. And he looked at me and said, you know, if you didn't notice that, then why are you giving such a hard time to everything else? You know, he basically cut me off at the knees with that. And I was humbled. I mean, he really put me in my place. And I said to myself, stop being a dick. You know, you're being a dick. Talk more about the positive aspects. You can still hate this movie. You can still talk about the science and rip it apart, but don't be a jerk about it. Don't be superior about it. And so I try to do that now, especially having a writer say, we need this to happen. You know, this is the plot and we need to get from point A to point B. And it's like, how do we do it? It's like, well, you can't. So we're going to have to figure out a way to make it happen that's scientifically incorrect, but is at least plausible.
Exactly. I mean, we saw that with The Martian. Like, I think a lot of people really laud The Martian as one of the most kind of pro-science and scientifically accurate books, which then became a movie of kind of our generation.
Yeah.
But there are still big conceits that were made. And Andy Weir will tell you straight up, he's like, I know there couldn't be a dust storm like that on Mars, but that's how it had to happen.
Right.
It's very important to the plot.
And I thought about it. You know, it's not really a spoiler. If you haven't seen The Martian, it's like the first 5 minutes of the movie.
Yeah.
You know he gets stranded on Mars. But yeah, there's a dust storm that blows off an antenna. It's like this really, it's like a hurricane and it spears him and they leave him for dead and he has to survive on Mars. And Mars, the atmosphere there is way too thin for that to happen. You would need winds at thousands of kilometers per hour to generate that kind of force because the air is so thin. And it's a gimme, you know, you just got to say, well, all right. And I sat down and thought, okay, I'm Andy Weir. I'm going to write this movie, this book. How do I make it dramatic and have the rest of his crew leave him for dead? Right.
Yeah.
It's not just that he can't just be sick. He can't just be out on an expedition because then they go look for him. There has to be a clear and immediate danger. And there's just nothing besides an asteroid impact. And that doesn't make much sense either. So
yeah, that would take the plot in a very different direction.
Yeah, exactly. So, I don't have a problem with it. And in the end, it's a great movie, really exciting, funny, very pro space exploration. Very, there are a lot of heroes in this movie, a lot of smart people making hard decisions. There are no bad guys in this movie.
That's true.
Even the head of NASA,
it's much loved.
Even the head of NASA, mm-hmm. who basically gets yelled at for making the decision to not try to rescue him. You know, he's making a decision he had to make. I feel for him, even if he's sort of portrayed as a bureaucratic jerk. I didn't really see it that way. So
yeah, there's no kind of like fumbly assholes. There's no like fall guy in the movie. It's like everybody has a complicated situation that they're in and they're doing their best. That's true. I never thought about it that way.
And I got to say, I look for movies like that. Hunt for Red October is another one where there's no really clear bad guy except maybe the Russian sub captain who comes in to attack Sean Connery, right? And Alec Baldwin. But even he is doing what he thinks is the right thing for his country. So he's not evil,
true.
And he winds up making a mistake. Well, maybe he's evil because he's going to kill this defector. But, you know, if you flip the roles and say, here's somebody, an American who has an advanced attack machine that he wants to make sure that, you know, the country doesn't use, you know, what do you do? There's a little more relativism that I like thinking about. And so seeing competent people making the best decisions they can with the data they have makes for a far better movie for me than somebody who's just an idiot or greedy or you know, so scared that they open the door and let the zombies out, something like that. That for me is just a device and it just leaves me cold.
And it's so one-dimensional. You know, all of this preface, obviously, the reason I reached out to you this go-around to ask you to come on the show was because I was just watching Arrival for the second time. I saw it in the theater because the guys from Skeptic's Guide wanted to review it on the show. And I, of course, like always, was like the last person to see the site. They're all like, okay, so we all saw this movie and we're going to review it. And I'm like, wait a minute. It's just like an assumption. It's like, give me a few days. Let me go to the theater. So I saw it in the theater, was blown away. Love the movie. And then, because I'm a member of SAG-AFTRA, because the SAG Awards are coming up, you get a bunch of screeners in the mail, which is really nice. So it was in the pile of screeners. And so I was able to watch it at home with my boyfriend because I really wanted him to see it. And I was able to kind of watch it for the second time and really watch for things I missed the first time. And so, of course, the second time, I actually saw the credits as they were rolling and I saw your name in there twice. And I realized, holy crap, you did some science advising on this movie. I loved this movie. I wanted to be able to talk with you a little bit about it. I don't want to spoil the movie, though. I know if you listen to the SGU discussion, it's full of spoilers. This movie is definitely a movie that has a plot twist that's important to not be spoiled. Otherwise, you don't get the core of it. That said, my number one thing that I loved about this movie more than anything else is that all of the sci-fi, all of the science, all of the technical stuff, all of the plot devices are in service to the character development and not the other way around.
That's right.
And because of that, I thought it was a beautiful, genius movie.
That's absolutely right. I didn't see it opening day. I saw it a couple of days after. And I have to say, basically the night it opened, I started getting tweets from people saying, hey, congratulations on Arrival. And I'm like, what are you talking about? and I went to see it. And sure enough, at the end of the movie, yeah, it says science advisor with my name. And then at the very end, it says special thanks to, and a list of people. And I was listed again. They misspelled my name the second time.
I know. I saw that. And I was wondering, is that the same Phil? I don't know.
How many Phil plates can there be? But, you know, people
right?
involved in this movie. Before I get to what my involvement, as small as it I loved how, in the movie, like you said, all of the science twists, all of the gimmies were basically to show you what the characters are going through. And it wasn't just, you know, aliens can just do this. It's like, no, the aliens can do this because da, 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 da. And it goes to the development it goes to the development of Amy Adams' character.
That's true. She's the obviously by far the most developed. The movie is really about her. It's very Contact in that way.
Yeah,
you know,
Jeremy Renner was just sort of her foil.
Yeah, that's true.
But I liked it, and I liked the characters. And again, you know, there's a military guy who is making decisions. A lot of people were complaining, like, he's just being a military jerk. And I'm thinking, aliens have appeared over the planet, and we have several other countries who are, you know, with their fingers on the trigger. You know, he's under a huge amount of pressure. And I thought the decisions he made weren't that terrible, given what he...
Are you talking about Forrest Whitaker's character?
Yeah,
I actually think that they did a good job of making him... quite likable in the film, because he actually expressed to Amy Adams' character or, you know, multiple times throughout the film, kind of who he was answering to up the chain and why they were asking the questions they were asking.
Yes.
Like, he was very much like, I'm in this position right now. I need to know why you're doing X so that I can explain to my boss why we don't have these answers yet. So I actually found him to be a very well-rounded character.
And also, I agree with you. That's great. And when he approaches Amy Adams the first time and he says, well, we got this other guy we're going to go to. And she basically says, ask him this as a test. Mm. And he comes back to her, you know, and it could have been played a lot of ways, but in the end, it was played such that his character was making the best choice for the job. He wasn't backed into a corner. It wasn't, you know, the president wants you. It's just, no, she clearly was the better person, so they pick her. And I just sat back and watched this and enjoyed it. And maybe this isn't a selling point for a lot of people, but for me it is. This movie is a slow burn.
Very slow burn, yeah.
There's one action scene, and it's over in 2 seconds.
Yep.
And it, it I wish it.
And it's really just a plot device.
But
it's only there to like to move the plot forward. That's all it is.
But I love movies that take their time and build, and so that when you get to the end, you don't have to have this ridiculous chase scene that doesn't make any sense plot wise or physically. You know, somebody jumping out of a skyscraper and catching themselves on the flagpole after they've already reached terminal velocity, stuff like that. I hate that. In this case, it builds and builds until you get to the critical scene and you're really on the edge of your seat. And there aren't many movies like that anymore. And so I really appreciated that.
I also really, and this is just a weird Kara-ism, and I think a handful of people might feel the same way. This movie had a very melancholy quality to it that I found to be incredibly beautiful. It was a bit gray the whole time. There was kind of a, and it really does lend itself to the ultimate twist, the ultimate plot point that I don't want to give away, but it has kind of a sadness to it without being overtly tearful, and a darkness to it that kept me really enthralled. Like it was very, the whole film was very bittersweet, just like life.
Very bittersweet.
It had very bittersweet. It didn't have like the cheesy toy with your heartstrings, you know, scenes. Everything was kind of good and bad at the same time. It was positive and negative at the same time. Many of the themes that we actually deal with in life. And the score was just stunning to this movie.
It was odd. And the sound effects were odd. I mean, it really, really compelling and good. And as a matter of fact, that reminds me, I need to buy the soundtrack. I've been meaning to do that. I'll make a note now. Thank you, Kara.
Yeah, I think the composer, I'm going to look it up to be sure, but I think the composer was Johan Johansson, who is a composer that my boyfriend introduced me to. He's really into kind of modern classical music.
Yeah.
And so I had already heard kind of that tone to it. And then the Max Richter song, which sort of bookends the film very beginning and at the very end, it's called, let me see if I can find it. On the Nature of Daylight. It had been in a playlist, actually my quote airplane music playlist, which I also listen to at the dentist, which is just kind of my calming music that helps me get through the flight. And so I really recognized it the minute I walked into the theater and the film started playing. And it just like struck me in a very emotional way. It's such a beautiful song. If anything, guys, download On the Nature of Daylight by Max Richter and listen to it. And that alone might make you want to see the film if you haven't yet.
At the risk of another tangent.
I love tangents.
Hang on.
Yes. No, I'd love it.
I listen to a lot of soundtracks. I grew up on classical music. So, you know, go ahead and grill me about Stravinsky and Shostakovich and all of that. But I love a lot of soundtracks. Some of them are sort of bubblegum music and they're just fun to listen to. But some of them have a depth and layering to them, which is, you know, every bit as good as a lot of the romantic music I grew up with. And I'm hearing soundtracks now where I'm blown away thinking, oh my God, that was a callback to that scene 20 minutes ago where this happened. So they're hinting at what's, you know, you can actually get plot points from this. Bear McCreary is another composer. He did Sarah Connor Chronicles, which I listen to quite often, and he did 10 Cloverfield Lane, another movie I've got to get the soundtrack to. But and he's done Outlander. He's written the music for that, and he's another science nerd. So you got you've got this guy who just I met him at Comic-Con, and he's grilling me about astronomy, and we become friends. And you know, we'll send each other notes sometimes, text each other. Hey, did you see this? Oh, this music. And it just, it thrills me that at all levels in Hollywood, for whatever you define Hollywood, movies, TV, everything, there is such a love of science that you know, the composers are interested in it. Everybody is. And it's thrilling.
Yeah, I agree. I absolutely agree. And I think that this film is a really good example of that. I think it was like, it's funny because yes, it's a sci-fi movie. Like, obviously that would be the genre that you would put it in because there are aliens in it. But it just felt like so much more than that to me. Because I've got to admit, as a nerd, the guys in the SGU give me shit all the time for it. I'm not a traditional nerd in the sense that I'm definitely not into fantasy. I don't like fantasy as a genre.
It never
It's hard for me. Yeah, I like clean sci-fi. I like, you know, I really love mid-century sci-fi that has more of kind of a social message to it. But I like fun sci-fi too, especially if the science feels cool and good. But when it borders on fantasy, it gets hard for me. And so for me, a good sci-fi film is one where it's not about the sci-fi. It's about so much more than that. And that's really what this film was.
Yeah.
Actually, before we return to the show, I have one more sponsor I want to thank this week. Talk Nerdy is lucky enough to be supported by Blue Apron. It's the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. And their mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. And they do it in a really smart way. They support more sustainable food. For example, the seafood is sourced under standards developed with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch. The beef, chicken, and pork come from responsibly raised animals. And all of their produce is sourced from farms that practice regenerative farming. The other really cool thing that they do to make Blue Apron sustainable is that they only deliver exactly the ingredients that you need to prepare a wholesome meal for yourself or your family. So there's no food waste. It's a really cool thing, you guys. And let me explain to you how it works. For less than $10 per person per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes with pre-portioned ingredients so that you can make those meals at home. You can spend time with your family. You feel good about cooking the food, but you don't have to be a genius chef to do it because everything is provided for you. It's also really flexible. You can customize those recipes each week based on your own preference, and it's guaranteed. Every ingredient in your delivery will arrive ready to cook, or Blue Apron will make it right. And I'm really excited to be partnering with them to continue to talk about their incredible product here on Talk Nerdy. So let me tell you a little bit about some of the meals that are coming up, like spicy shrimp and Korean rice cakes with cabbage and furikake. See, I don't even know what that is, but it sounds delicious. Pork chops and garlic piccata with scallion rice and spinach, or mushroom and chipotle pepper enchiladas with lime sour cream. Something totally different every night for your family. So guys, check out this week's menu and get your first three meals for free. You hear that? Three meals. You can get all three of those things I listed with free shipping. And you can get that just by visiting blueapron.com/nerdy. You're going to love how good it feels and tastes to create those home cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. Go to blueapron.com/nerdy. That's blueapron.com/nerdy. All right, guys, now let's get back to the show. So what did you do on it? How did it work? Did you just answer a few emails? Did you go into some rooms? Like, what is it like to be a science advisor on a film? I'm sure it, you know, runs the gamut.
Well, actually, in many cases, as a movie is being written, they will contact the Science Entertainment Exchange and say, we need somebody who's an expert on whatever. In my case, it didn't really happen that way. It was an accident. Although the exchange was involved, on occasion, I will go to California and the exchange will basically parade me around various production companies that are looking for a little more science. Sometimes it's specific. They've got a specific thing they're working on. They want somebody, you know, maybe they just want to know a little bit about astronomy or space exploration. Sometimes they're just tossing around ideas and they want to talk to a scientist who may have some experience with it. So it's like speed dating. So I'll go to like four of these things a day over the weekend, different production companies. And one of them was working on a science fiction movie, which actually sounded pretty interesting. I read the script and sent them some notes. And then a couple of months later, that same person I talked to said, you know, we've got this other movie we're involved with, and it's called The Story of Your Life. Would you like to take a look at the script and see it? And I was like, oh, I heard about that short story. It's very popular. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd love to. Send it to me. So they sent it to me, and it's this. The original short story is called Story of Your Life. It was changed to Arrival, you know, for whatever reasons. And I read the script, and the script I read was very close to what was filmed. After watching the movie, I went back and reread it. It's like, okay, I can see where it was a little bit different here and there. And they cleaned it up a little bit and da, da, da. But in the script, I basically only had two or three suggestions. One, and I'll get nerdy here. The Jeremy Renner character is a scientist, Ian Donnelly. And when they bring him and Amy Adams's character together to the area where they're talking to the aliens, he says, "Have you tried communicating with them? Have they sent you any code, any mathematical things like a Fourier series?" And I'm reading this in a script and I thought, well, a Fourier series isn't like an actual series of numbers. It's more a way of analyzing a signal that has cycles to it, like sines and cosines. You break it down into trigonometric functions, and then you can analyze it that way and figure some things out about it. So it's not like aliens would send that. It's not like they would send like a list of prime numbers, which you don't expect a natural phenomenon to do. A supernova or a gas cloud isn't going to emit prime numbers. And if you want to communicate with aliens, you want to set up a sort of maybe a mathematical or scientific basis to do that to start with. It just seems natural because the laws of the universe don't care about your language. They just are. So I said, maybe he should say a Fibonacci series. And that's the series that goes 0, 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21, 34. Can I do that? Where each number is the sum of the previous two. So
you see that everywhere 0, 1, in nature, right?
That shows up in nature, but it's also an unusual series of numbers to be able to just list. And it would make sense for that to be something aliens might broadcast as a common basis. And it turns out, they took that suggestion. Jeremy Renner actually says that in the movie. And so, 20 minutes into the movie, my ears pricked up when he said that. I was like, wait a minute, Fibonacci. That's what I said. Oh my God.
And you know what's cool about that you made that suggestion is that it doesn't sound as sciencey, but it's more accurate. And they went with something that actually makes more sense scientifically, but sounds more layman-y. Because I think most people have kind of heard of Fibonacci. Like that's something that, if they hear it, they go, oh yeah, I know that. That's like a thing in math. But the other one, the Fourier series sounds very technical.
It is. And so the irony is that you use the Fourier series in signal processing. So if they sent a signal, you might break it down. If you ever heard the term power spectrum, that's where you do a Fourier analysis on it. So it's ironic that it's actually kind of the wrong thing to say.
That is funny. Yeah. But sometimes what we'll see that happen in films where just because it sounds it's psychobabble or it's technobabble, they'll choose something that sounds more sciencey and technical just for that reason, even though it doesn't make sense,
right,
over something that makes sense, even if it's a little simpler. And so I think it's cool that they took that suggestion because it sounds less sciencey,
I thought of that.
Which is cool.
And I mean, it's a trivial change. They could have taken it or not. And it's not like I was a huge influence or anything. Obviously not. It was a word. But the experience of sitting in the audience and hearing that, and it was like, holy shit, that was cool. And the other
cool
suggestions, I had a few other specific ones, but relatively minor. And the other thing I was talking about was the aliens themselves. And without spoiling the movie, the way the aliens look and walk and act, they are way far advanced of us and they think differently than us, which I feel is an important aspect. When I was reading science fiction as a kid, a lot of aliens were just like, caricatures of humans. Klingons are just warlike and Romulans are very officious. And, whenever an alien, it's just mean or happy but in fact, the aliens that are nuanced, it's like given the circumstances of their planet, how would they evolve differently? And when writers take that into account and you have an alien ecosystem, a sociology that is internally consistent because of that, that sinks in better with me. I appreciate it more. And I felt that way with these aliens. And so I suggested, given what we know about these aliens and the way they behave is important to the plot, I had some suggestions about the way they move and how they would manipulate objects. And it was kind of sort of in the script already, but I don't know how much credit I can take for that. Maybe I help them move it along. Maybe not. I don't know. I'm not just being modest. I honestly don't know. And false modesty is not a characteristic of mine. But neither is false bravado. It's just, it is what it is, as far as I'm concerned. And so it was so much fun to say, here are aliens who think this way and do this. What are they going to look like? You know, we can't, for example, see behind us. We don't have eyes in the back of our head. And so we have, and we have a day-night cycle, for example, where we are, we're diurnal. We're up during when the sun is up and we go to sleep when it's night. That profoundly affects everything about everything we do, from phrases we have to the way we perceive the way things go on around us. And so if you have an alien, as an example, not necessarily from this movie, but if you have an alien that lives on a planet where the sun never sets, the planet is so close to its star that it's tidally locked and it rotates at the same speed it spins around the planet. So you don't get day-night cycles. I won't go into details because I'm not trying to drive this point home, but how does that change an alien species where it's always daylight? Or if they can see, if they have eyes all the way around their body and they can see behind them, or there's no difference between their arms and their legs. And it was really fun to think about that and see how it would affect how they try to communicate with us and vice versa.
Yeah, and just the possibilities really are endless. That's why I think science fiction can be so incredibly creative. Because if you think about there are so many constraints on Earth. Like, we evolved a very specific way because of the, you know, the pressures, the natural pressures around us. And sometimes you'll even see, like, convergent evolution. You'll see the same things evolving over and over at different periods
of time. Oh, sure. Dolphins and sharks is the classic example.
Yeah. And that's because the pressures are so strong that it just, it happens to be the case that this sort of feature or this sort of trait is just very helpful in that environment. So it'll evolve in totally different lineages. But, you know, we're just so locked and bound by the Earth environment. It's hard for us to think beyond that. Just like you said, what if the sun never set? Or what if the atmosphere was made of totally different chemicals? What if, you know, there were no plants and they somehow sort of respired differently than we do? Like, all of those things will feed in to how we actually think, how we ambulate, how we eat, whether or not we do eat. You know, like, the way that we think of life and how we define life is narrow because of our experience on Earth. And I think that's why it's so cool when I talk to astrobiologists, whose whole job it is to kind of combine physics and biology to creatively think about, would we even know life or recognize life if we saw it in an alien world? Because it could be so different from our parameters.
Oh, it's funny you'd say that. That's exactly what I was just thinking. You know, you might step right over something that's alive and not even know it.
Yeah, because it looks like a rock. I mean, we see that all the time on our planet. There are species that we didn't know existed because their camouflage was so good.
Or they're just life as we think about it.
Yes, but like a sea sponge or coral.
Lichens and stuff that lives 2 miles beneath the surface of the Earth that feeds off of radioactivity, creating chemical changes in the rocks around them. I mean, this is stuff that's so alien to our existence. We, you know, you could literally step right over it. And what if you go to a place like Titan, Saturn's big moon? You know, Titan has an atmospheric pressure on its surface twice the Earth's, and its atmosphere is mostly nitrogen, most like ours. You know, ours is mostly nitrogen, although we breathe the oxygen. There's also methane in the atmosphere of Titan, and methane acts like water there. We have frozen solid water on Earth. We have liquid water, and we have it in our atmosphere in the three different states. The same on Titan for methane. It exists as vapor and solid and liquid on the surface. You could have methane-based life the way we're water-based, but it's so cold there that the chemical processes might run much slower than they do here. So, you know, something might live for 1,000 years there and move so slowly we don't even notice it. I'm totally making that last part up.
But that's
fascinating. Maybe there are chemical reactions that move more rapidly, but how do you know?
Yeah, because that is based on our understanding of Earth metabolism.
Right.
And kind of the speed at which our different enzymes have to, you know, kind of fire off. It's it's fascinating. I mean, the possibilities are endless. And that's why it is kind of a bummer and it is a little bit lazy when you see sci-fi where the aliens are just so humanoid.
Yeah, and even in Arrival, there were a couple of moments where the aliens do things that were kind of human-ish. Mm-hmm. And the way they react to things, and I went, oh.
Yeah, like we didn't need that. But it's such a kind of personal limitation because that's how we think. And in many times, it may not even be the decision of the director, the producer, may be actually a deeper thought than what we think, instead of it being a restriction of their mindset. Like, oh, well, that's how I would think that they should react. They may be thinking, well, the audience is going to experience this more emotionally because they right. can, you know, empathize with it. If they react in such a different way than what we're used to, we might not be able to connect with these creatures emotionally. So
right.
it's, you know, it's complicated and brilliant, but I definitely recommend this film. I think that it's got so much more good than bad. And I really hope Amy Adams wins some awards for it.
She was really good. She's really good in this. I really like her. And yet the movie, the thing I want to say about this movie, there are signs that a movie is better than you might expect. Nowadays, if a movie doesn't do well, it's opening weekend. You know, it's a bomb. And most movies are in and out of the theaters rapidly. If you go see a movie 2 weeks after it opens, the theater's empty. When I was a kid, yeah. it wasn't like that. It's different because of the internet now and everything else. But still, movies tend to come and go really rapidly. And Arrival was doing well weeks after it premiered. It was word of mouth. And when you see these cult hits that do really well, like, Napoleon Dynamite is the one that comes to mind mm-hmm. for some reason. That movie was popular because of word of mouth. It was a low budget.
Yeah, it didn't do that well opening weekend because people didn't even think it was anything.
Yeah, and Arrival's kind of the same way. I mean, it has some big names and it was a long time in the making. I saw the script 3 years ago.
Wow.
But it's one of these things where it's still doing well. I don't know about now, but for weeks it was doing well up to Christmas. And that makes me really happy. That's a sign of a movie that is not just something you go see and forget about immediately. People are going to, I've had friends contacting me saying, I saw your name in the movie. I don't understand this part of the movie. Can you help me understand it? And I've explained it and they're like, oh my God. It's like, yeah,
great.
This is a good flick.
Yeah, I really need to read the short story because since we did the review on SGU, so many kind of fans of the show have written in and said, you know, some of the things that maybe you were confused by or you were questioning or you thought were shortcomings, like they're all explained in the short story and it's really beautiful. And, isn't that always the case? Like, the book is always just that much better than the movie. So
yeah, I'm not sure how he pronounces his name, but it's Ted Chiang, and I've actually got it. I've got it on Amazon. It's on my list. It's like, yeah, I got to get this.
yeah. Because it's the bummer is when you do it this way. Like when I read The Martian, I didn't even know the film was coming out, and I definitely didn't know that Matt Damon was cast in it. So Mark Watney was just a character I invented in my head.
Yeah, me too.
And only later did he become Matt Damon. But this time now, the lead is just going to be Amy Adams for me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's
like,
true.
It's going to be hard to imagine somebody different, but that she was so good. It's okay. I know. Well, okay. I want to ask you a couple of more things. I want to get off the movie and jump back into your writing because sure. I feel like we might not have broached the subject, and it was especially not as relevant the last time that we chatted on the show.
Well, that was 100 years ago.
Exactly. And a lot has happened since then. So one of the things I really admire about how you write is that obviously you work as, a premier science communicator, meaning that you care so much about science literacy. It's very important that you make sure that the public is informed about what's going on. You counter misconceptions in a really brilliant way, and you do it in a very colloquial, easy to understand way. But I think you go one step beyond that in that you don't shy away from potentially contentious or politically charged topics like many science communicators do. I feel the same way. I don't do it in such an organized way as you do. I have like my political opinions and then I like to talk about science. On the SGU, for example, sort of the editorial policy is that we avoid politics because we know that we have listeners from all sides of the aisle. We actually have individuals on the show from all sides of the aisle. But lately, it's becoming harder and harder not to bump up against that wall. And
Whatever do you mean, Kara?
And so tell me if I'm wrong, but from an outsider reading your post, I feel like you fully embrace the fact that like, this is the political climate. These are the things that are anti-science in it. I'm not going to pretend that in order to be politically quote unquote neutral, I can't even talk about them. Like you go there and I really commend you for that.
Well, thank you. That's very nice of you. And I honestly appreciate that. It's, there are a lot of ways of looking at this. You know, if you're writing for a science magazine that is just science and is just talking about research in science or interesting news that comes out, you might not want to get political because you want this information to get out to people. And as soon as you say something about politics, you're immediately slicing off half your audience. And I get that. That's fine. It's totally understandable. And I would make the same decision. On the other hand, I'm watching my science get attacked for years now. Back in the Bush administration, back is I guess when I started writing about this kind of thing, and I couldn't stand by and watch it happen. Sure, some of it was in my field. We had a creationist, a young Earth creationist, who was a political appointee in NASA at their communication office, and he was basically changing press releases and saying the Big Bang didn't happen. And it's like you're talking for NASA. Yeah. Oh my God, you can't do that. And so, this is personal. This is science. I mean, it's impersonal, but it's also personal. When you're attacking science, I'm going to take that personally, even though it may be an impersonal attack. But it's also, you know, in science, you may not always know a thing, and new research may sway you one way or another. And this is certainly true in medical research, where you know they study the effects of coffee, and in this group, coffee helped them, poop. I don't know, whatever. And in this other group, it made them cognitively impaired for an hour after they drank it. Whatever. I'm making this up. The point is, you know, the research goes around, and you're not sure. Da da da. On the other hand, evolution is true. The Big Bang happened. The Earth is old. Climate change is real. And if you want to argue how much humans are influencing climate change, that's an interesting topic. Now, we are influencing it strongly, but what I mean is, for example, we're dumping, 40 billion tons of carbon dioxide into the air. How is that going to affect our temperature? Are we going to see a 4 degrees Celsius rise in the next century or 2 degrees? That's a huge difference. Yeah. That sort of thing, scientifically, you can argue about. Whether humans are influencing the climate or not is no longer something you can argue about scientifically. We know for a fact we are. So if you're going to go and write an article saying humans aren't influencing the climate, you're full of it. And I'm going to call you out on it. I can't sit back and watch that happen. In a sense I do, because I see news every single frickin' day. Anti-vaxxers.
Yeah, you can't be writing 24/7.
Yeah, it's just there's too much and there are too many people out there. So I let a lot of stuff go by because it's just, you know, I'm not going to go into that. It's kind of like UFOs. Every UFO claim, I can't spend my time saying that's a reflection inside the camera, that's a street light. You know, you can't do that. You're just going to waste all your time. So I wait for something that is important, like when a representative like Lamar Smith, who is in charge of the Science, Space, and Technology Committee for the House of Representatives, goes on a witch hunt, which may not be a good term to use anymore. That got all kinds of loaded political problems with it. But when he goes on a fishing expedition and is attacking scientists and other people because he thinks climate change is fake, and the reasons he believed that may have to do with the amount of money he gets from fossil fuel companies, or he may just be deluded. But either way, he's wrong. And he's attacking scientists who are trying to save the planet. And he is preventing them from doing this because of his political ideology. Yeah, yeah, I'm going to say something about that. I can't morally stand by and watch that kind of thing happen without saying something.
And recently, I mean, I've noticed a handful of times when you've had to write direct kind of pieces about tweets that the House Science Committee has put out that are blatantly climate denial.
They
link tweets.
To Breitbart.
It's Breitbart. Crazy. That is a, like, what is happening?
That is a, you know, an air quote alt-right site. That's an it's a modern day it's a white supremacy, white nationalist site, whatever phrase you want to use. And all they are interested in is their own political narrow ideology. And so they are climate change deniers over there. They're racist. They're misogynist. And so for the House Science Committee to tweet out a link to that, which is a blatantly incorrect interpretation of a climate change argument. Yeah, yeah, I'm going to come in and say something about that. And they've been doing it since. Whoever's running the Twitter feed for the Science Committee has just been linking to absolute nonsense. And it's terrifying to think that the only thing that was holding these folks in check was that we had a progressive president, because now we no longer do. And I honestly have existential dread over the next at least 2 years until the midterm elections. The only thing I can hope for is that the conservatives are going to shoot themselves in the foot so badly that people will vote in droves. But that's typically not what happens at the midterms. But I'm honestly scared.
Me too. And, you know, I think that what's kind of unsaid here is that there's a much deeper sort of background problem that's occurring. It's not just that there's like overt anti-science and we can point to it and say, holy shit, what's happening to our country? Or, oh my God, look at the regressives are, you know, kind of now in charge and they're going to start passing kind of this conservative anti-science agenda. But we're also chipping away, and I say we, I'm not a part of this, but we're seeing a chipping away of public trust, because when the actual individuals who are, you know, when it's the House Science Committee, that's your government, that's, you know, supposed to be a voice that no matter what you can turn to and say, okay, these are the people that know what they're talking about, and they are pushing an anti-science agenda and they're pushing rhetoric that's like fake news, it becomes harder and harder for the general public to know what's real. And that scares me almost more than the actual agendas that are going to continue to be pushed through.
You're absolutely right. And that's blatantly true for everything that we're seeing coming out where the president-elect will just lie. I mean,
he'll just say what he feels.
His tweets are, I mean, they're profoundly obvious that what he's saying is just a lie. I like to not use that word. Let me rephrase that in a more grammatically careful structurement. I don't like to use the word lie, because lie implies intent. You know, you can be wrong. I know people who think the moon landings are fake. And when they say we never landed on the moon, I don't say you're lying. I think they believe what they're saying. But in the case where Trump says this report says this, and it's like, no, it doesn't. It says the opposite.
Yeah. Like, you just read it. You were just briefed on it. Yeah, like you're just saying that to manipulate people.
And he says, I'm going to do this next week. I'm going to have a press conference, and it doesn't happen. It's like, at what point, you know, are you going to stop kicking at the football that Lucy is holding? Right. We are all Charlie Brown here. We need to stop running up to that football and say, yeah, I'm not playing the game anymore. Sadly, though, they're the ones who are holding the keys to the country. And so as long as that's going to be the case, you know, we have to say something. Science used to not be political, at least not this way. It wasn't partisan. And in fact, back in the day, it was more of the conservatives who were pro-science, and it was the liberals who were sort of not anti-science, but against some of the progress we made with science.
I'm anti-establishment.
Yeah,
you know, anti-establishment. Kind of just good. Questioning. I mean,
there were the ones who didn't want to go to the moon, or the ones who didn't want to fund certain research, Proxmire and his Golden Fleece Award. These were more on the Democrat side than the Republican side. And now that's reversed. And it's the Republicans, it's the conservatives who weaponized science and basically hooked their wagon to the moral majority, to the religious right, and to fossil fuel. And so now you see all of this anti-science coming from them. And you can say, well, the liberals do it too. And it's like, well, not to the same extent. And it's not the same way. GMOs are not, for example, which tend to be more of a liberal thing than a conservative thing, and for different reasons. It's not like that's being used to attack things. It's just a it is what it is. And when you look at anti-vax movements, they typically run the gamut of the political spectrum. The far left thinking that you're putting poisons in your system, they want to be sort of all natural, and the far right because you don't want the government mandating people should get vaccines.
Yeah, and it looks like the highest correlate of that movement really is just youth. It's really just it's young parents. You know, younger people tend to be more anti-vax.
Subtle in many ways situation, but when it comes to climate change, no, it is partisan. It was the conservatives who basically made this their case, and creationism, anti-evolution, typically, and by typically I mean overwhelmingly, you will find some folks in government who are possibly liberal, but also who might also be very religious or whatever, who might believe in a young earth. But typically it is the right. And it's the right who have definitely weaponized this, put out their fake websites, have gone out and made what we call astroturfing, websites that look like they're grassroots movement, but they're fake. This was done with tobacco, and it's being done with climate change now. And it's terrifying.
That's the thing that's so frustrating is that, you know, there are plenty of conservatives who obviously know that anthropogenic climate change is real. There are plenty of moderate conservatives and actually most of the constituency agrees with this.
That is correct.
It's that there's a targeted, very specific agenda-driven movement. It's not about like, oh, there's just some misinformation out there, or, oh, well, this is what we think and this is what you think and we'll agree to disagree. It's like, no, I can trace back what is being said to who first said it and how they funded it and what they want to get out of it. That's the frustrating part.
That's correct.
Is that it makes me sound like a conspiracy theorist, but there actually is a conspiracy happening, and it's incredibly dangerous because it's that kind of minority of voices who have a lot of sort of a lot of money and a lot of ability to influence policy and to influence hearts and
minds.
That's
correct. And I like to say, I get attacked for it. You're making this partisan. It's like, no, I'm not. I did not make this partisan. The far right did. And so I have to fight this battle on that term. You know, you can say I'm partisan. I call this denial's dark mirror, that they accuse everybody else of doing what they're doing. And this is a long-standing tradition that dates back. I mean, the Hitler did it, not to necessarily Godwinize this conversation. What I mean is that as propaganda goes, accusing the other person of doing what you're doing is a great way of fobbing off the blame. But in this case, there is a conspiracy. I mean, this is a conspiracy. It's a conspiracy of people who are trying to deny climate change. And the thing is, you can say to people, do you think there was a conspiracy by tobacco executives to downplay the health dangers of tobacco smoking? And the answer to that is yes, because we have proof that they did.
Yeah, there's evidence.
Proof that doubt is their product. This is a quote from a tobacco executive internal memo. And the tobacco executives all basically, they were called in front of Congress. They were not sworn in. This was a big deal when it happened. Mm-hmm. And they were asked, do you think nicotine is addictive? And they all said no. And it's like, you guys are just lying. And the thing is, a lot of the same quote-unquote think tanks that were involved with tobacco, were paid for this tobacco propaganda, are now doing the same thing with climate change. And it's like, you want a conspiracy? There it is. Conspiracies exist. Iran-Contra happened. Right. There's always conspiracies that actually exist. The question is, are they, you know, are the ones you're talking about real? Do you have evidence for it? And what are we going to do about it?
Yeah, and that's the annoying thing. We have plenty of evidence to show that this is a conspiracy, yet it still holds. And a lot of it has to do with a brilliant campaign on the right to undermine the fundamentals of trust so that all of a sudden, you know, the media is liberal and has an agenda.
They've been
all
playing
of a sudden,
long game.
Exactly. Like, truth is liberal and has an agenda. So now I don't know what to believe because I don't know how I define truth. And all of the people who I thought were incredibly trustworthy, kind of agnostic, nonpartisan individuals on television who are just telling me what's happening in the world, oh, they're actually trying to get Hillary Clinton elected, so I can't trust them anymore. Like, it's a very dangerous thing when we start to see an unraveling of the foundation of trust in a democracy. And that is what scares the living piss out of me the most about Donald Trump. It's his relationship with the press. It's his relationship with the truth and about kind of the cabinet, you know, appointees and, generally speaking, Congress, to a lesser extent. I know Congress has the power to get way more done. So obviously it's super scary that we have a majority Republican Congress, both in the House and the Senate. But I still think there are plenty of moderate Republicans who are like intelligent, functional beings within our legislature. So it scares me a little bit less. But still, yeah, it's that undermining of institution. And that makes me sound like a conservative. That's not a progressive thing to say, that I'm scared of the undermining of our core institutions. I want there to be conservatism in how we do government.
Yeah,
I want to do things the same way that we've done them for a long time, and I don't want to see that start to break down.
Well, you're absolutely right, and the conservatives are no longer conservative. I mean, and let me be careful here. There are conservative people, and I'm conservative in many ways. I even have libertarian leanings on a lot of things.
And most scientists, to be honest, have a lot of conservative leanings because science is fundamentally conservative, but that's a whole other
thing. Yeah, it's conservative and progressive. It's conservative in that, you know, we have these rules and we want to stick with them, but then this new thing comes along and you have to show me a lot of evidence and eventually it becomes the new thing. And so it's progressive that way. But for me, people like Trump and Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, these are not conservative people. These are radicals. They are now the radicals who are trying to fundamentally change the meaning of our democracy. And that is not conservative. They as much as they like to wave the flag and talk about the founding fathers, their ideology goes completely against what our country is all about. I would say they're anti-American. This Muslim rhetoric, the building of a wall, this is not our country. The Statue of Liberty says, you know, we welcome your poor and your huddled masses. These are the folks we want coming here because they yearn for freedom. That is what, you know, and you can talk about capitalism and hypocrisy of our government and the white privilege and the oppression of black people and trans and everything. And yes, absolutely. Mea culpa, me personally and my country, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But the point of America as an idea is to strive to do better. Is to strive to give people the opportunity to become who they want and need to be. That may not happen, and it doesn't happen a lot. But what we're seeing coming in now is an absolute choking of even that amount of the dream of this country.
And at least even with Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, you can look at them and say, I understand your agenda. It's misguided and it's wrong. And I mean, I can sit here, you may not agree, but say that it's morally bankrupt. But I can point to your agenda and say, I see what you're trying to do and I want to make sure that it doesn't happen. Whereas with Donald Trump, he's like such a scary figure. He has all of the makings of a dictatorial figure because it's not about an agenda. It's only about him. It seems like the intrinsic motivation for almost every decision is kind of a narcissistic, infantile, reactionary.
Yeah.
It's so scary to me because, I mean, luckily we have such a good division of power in our country that like our president can't ever be a dictator. But this is, I feel like, the first time in a very long time of American history that we've overtly chosen somebody with dictatorial leanings to have that executor role.
I'm not sure I agree with you. Everything you said is correct, except the system that we have in place
gotcha.
Is based on custom in a lot of cases. So we have all of these cabinet picks, people who are grossly unqualified for what they're being appointed to and who are suffering under massive conflicts of interest. And the Senate is saying, hey, let's get these folks in. And the ethics folks are saying, you know, we take months to do this and you want to appoint these cabinet members in a couple of weeks.
And then the Senate saying, let's get rid of you, ethics committee.
Yeah. And the Senate is saying, no, let's get these folks in there. And remember, these are the same people who are saying we can control Trump once he's president. That was one of the things that they were literally saying during the campaign. Don't worry about how Trump is a loose cannon. You know, we'll be able to control him. And it's like you're rolling over for his cabinet picks and you look at
they're so afraid that the party. Yeah, because they're afraid that the party is becoming factioned. And so
party over country.
They would. Yeah, it's so sad. It's like, gosh, now more than ever is bipartisanship like so lost. I remember kind of rolling my eyes at past presidents when I was younger, making sort of, you know, paying lip service to trying to being bipartisan. And, you know, once they actually get inaugurated, being, oh, okay, now all the divisiveness is over and we've got to work together and be like, yeah, okay, but we'll see how that really works. But like now that's not even, there's not even a charade about that. It's like he literally on New Year's Eve or on New Year's Day or whatever said, fuck you to half the country and called us his enemies.
Yeah.
Like, what is that?
Yeah, and a couple of weeks before his inauguration, he's tweeting about his TV show and mocking Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's like, really, you have nothing else to do. You know, and
crazy.
I have time to tweet. I can tweet pictures of my goats. I'm not going to be president of the United States. You know, I wouldn't be ignoring intelligence briefings or anything. It's like, this is not like, you know, being on the board of advisors for a company where it's you know, but mostly just a something you can put on your resume. This is a real thing. And I don't think he's still done any kind of actual training for it.
No, I mean, there's no evidence at least that he has. Have you seen, there's this parody account on Twitter right now. I can't remember what it's called. I could probably look it up, but it's so sad because it's like an anti-parody account. They basically take, I think it's like presidential Trump or maybe presidential Donald Trump. They take every one of his petty bullshit tweets and then rewrite it as like, this is what a president would have tweeted.
Yeah, I've seen that. It's amazing.
Sad. It's amazing and depressing. Yeah. It's like, oh my God. Well, you know, Phil, you have given me so much of your day, and I've been having such a blast. I thought it might be cool to close the show the same way I always do, asking my two questions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you did that the last time you were on the show, but obviously so much has changed. I'd be interested to see if your answers have changed as well. So you want to you down with that? You want to dive into that?
Sure. I don't think my answer's going to change, but we'll see.
Okay, we'll see.
I remember what
I said. The first question. Yeah. Oh, good. Good. So yeah, the first question is when you look to the future, what are you most concerned about and what keeps you up the most at night? And on the flip side of that, to close on something of a positive note, what are you hopeful for and what do you look forward to and have optimism about?
The last time I was on, I said climate change and it kept me up at night and worried me the most. And I remember listening to your podcast. I don't remember to whom you were speaking now. It was a few episodes later. And somebody said that, and you said, everybody says that. And I remember laughing.
Yeah, they
I was driving in the car and laughing and saying, well, yeah, I mean, what else is there? You're talking to a scientist. We all know what climate change is and what it's going to do. So that's our biggest existential threat right now. When I was a kid, in the middle of the Cold War, I used to be very worried about nuclear war. I mean, that's it, for people who are maybe in their 30s or even young 40s these days, that might be tough to imagine. But it really was a concern. And now it's becoming a concern again. I still would say climate change, but if I had to be specific, if I could be more general, I would say it's what we were talking about before. It's this erosion of reality in general, where people can't get information that they can trust to be accurate, whether they know it or not. People tend to buy into the news they hear that matches their ideology, that runs parallel with their belief system. So if you think climate change is a fraud, you're not going to believe me or, you know, Michael Mann or Peter Gleick or any of these other, you know, the climatologists doing this. You're going to believe the people who poo-poo it. And that worries me more, maybe even than climate change, because it hits everything. It hits religious freedom. It hits women's rights. It hits minority rights. It hits LGBT rights. Because, you know, when you read on Breitbart that Muslims were rioting in Germany and set fire to a church, and it's like, no, none of that happened. It's just propaganda, but people are going to believe it. So that worries me. We have to have a concerted effort to downplay that. What gives me hope for the future are the people out there who won't buy the bullshit. I think there are more of us than there are them, the people who are willing to deny reality. I think there are more people who accept reality, accept science. Science is self-correcting. It is a skeptical look at itself. And if you buy into that, you don't get bamboozled necessarily by the science, or it's a lot harder. And so I love people who say science is just a rigid belief system. It's like, no, it's not. You're mistaking that for politics.
You're kind of misunderstanding the foundation of what science is.
And I think a lot of people get that. And it seems I don't want to sound like I'm trivializing it, but the fact that movies have better science in them and TV shows, and we're seeing better science on TV. We have a whole channel dedicated to science, and they make their mistakes. Discovery Channel, Science Channel, mermaids and Megalodon and all that. Mm-hmm. But by and large, they're putting science on the air, and there are people, you know, I write a blog that gets a million page views a month, and I'm writing about, you know, pretty specific stuff. And there are other people out there who are writing these topics and getting as much traffic. There are millions and millions of people out there who want the science. They hunger for it. They crave it. They want to be dazzled by reality. And that's what reality is. There's nothing mundane around you, nothing. Just the grass growing in your backyard is a fantastic story that stretches back to the Big Bang itself. And when you realize that, when you internalize it, you walk around wide-eyed all the time, just amazed at what you're seeing. And when you see attacks on that, you take it personally. And there is more motivation to make sure that people understand reality for the way it is. That is what gives me hope.
See, Phil, this is why I love having you on my show.
Well, I like you too, Kara. come on. I mean, with SGU and everything you're doing, everything you've been doing, all of the media that you do, my heavens, you've reached far more people than I have. And you're putting all of that out there. And also, hey, role model for women. That's Aww. Something I cannot do. I can stand on my soapbox and say, you know, middle-aged white guy here saying we need more people of color, more women doing this. But you're out there walking the walk. But
hey, man, I mean, I would say white guys, you know, straight white guys out there who are pro science, pro women, pro minority, pro LGBT, you know, just in general, like it's so important that you have your voices be heard and that you do kind of advocate as often as possible. And I so appreciate that you do, because we're still in a position where oftentimes people are going to listen to you before they listen to me. And so to be able to have the same, I know it's just a harsh
the
reality.
Ultimate irony of
it
being
is, right?
A balding, bearded, middle-aged white guy son is that it's like, you're going to listen to me before you listen to Kara. Or, you know, this other astronomer over here. And so what I have to do is basically stand up on my soapbox, say, hey, go listen to her.
Yeah. And it's so appreciated. And it's weird, but it's so necessary and it's so appreciated. And the truth of the matter is you are an endless source of like brilliance and knowledge. And you have this special skill to ensure that the people who are reading your work, they get it. Like when I read your blogs, I get it. And trust me, my background does not overlap with yours at all.
Yeah, I know. We've had that conversation before.
I am so limited in that area. And so it's so fun when I get to read about physics and astronomy and cosmology and be like, oh my God, I understand that principle now. Or like I look up at the night sky and I know what I'm looking at because I read because I read Bad Astronomy. So I really appreciate all that you do, all that you continue to do. And I appreciate you being such a good friend to me over the years and always being willing to come on the show.
Well, thank you. That's lovely to hear. And that's the highest praise a science communicator can possibly get is, you know, I understand this stuff now. And you know, that's all we're trying to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, the battle is, will continue to be uphill. There will be times with more resistance and times where it's more difficult. And we're looking into that kind of fog right now, but that doesn't mean that anything really changes. We continue to do what we do and we'll get out on the other side of this. We always have, we always will, because like you said so eloquently previously, science is dynamic and it will always kind of brush off its shoulders and show the truth and show the light. And so I continue to have faith in that. And I appreciate the soldiers of science, you being one of the most important. So again, thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me back. And next time we can go into more depth about the privilege and all of that, because I think that's also important. That'll be fun.
Yeah, of course. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.